You're listening to What the Hell is Michael Jammin Talking About? Conversations in writing, art, and creativity. Today's episode is brought to you by my debut collection of true stories, A Paper Orchestra, available in print, ebook, and audiobook. To purchase and to support me and this podcast, please visit michaeljammin.com/book. And now, on with the show. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of What the Hell is Michael Jammin Talking About? Conversations in writing, art, and creativity. And today I got a special guest for you musicians out there. You don't deserve any of this. This is a wonderful treat for all of you. Don't say I never gave you anything. I'm here with Dave Rose from Deep South Entertainment, and he is a career music manager. But Dave, first of all, welcome. I got a billion questions for you. But did you start off are you a musician as well?
Thank you. Good to be here, Michael. Man, I'm mutual admiration all the way around. This is exciting to be here. But yes, I started out as a musician. I started out as a musician. I mean, yes and no. That there's a story, but I became a musician out of necessity.
How does that work? No one becomes, that's like the last thing you become out of necessity.
I know. Isn't that funny? I was managing, and I very much put that in air quotes. I was a freshman in college, and I had a local band decide they wanted me to be their manager because I was showing up at all their gigs and selling merchandise and unloading the van and doing all the things that I thought I could do to help. I just loved being around music. And one day they said to me, "Would you be our manager?" Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what the hell a manager was. I still don't. But they said, "Well, you could start by getting us some gigs." And that's not what a manager does, by the way. But that's, you know, when you're in college, that's what you do.
Wait, that's not what a manager does? What does then? Okay. You have to elaborate on that.
We can get into that for sure. But they... So I got them 20 gigs and we had it all booked up and we're all ready to go. And we were 2 weeks out from the very first gig, big string of shows, you know, playing skate ranches and pool parties and all the places that you play when you're just starting out anywhere and everywhere that'll give you room. And they came to me and they said, "Our bass player quit and he's moving. And so we need to cancel these gigs and we can no longer, you know, we'll audition new bass players later." And I said, like, hell you are. I've been watching this. It doesn't look like it's that hard to play bass. So here's what we're going to do. Uh-huh. I'm going to cram myself in the basement with you, Mr. Guitar Player. And you're going to teach me all the parts to these songs. We're going to go play these 20 shows with me as the bass player. And when we come back, you can audition bass players. And that's how this. And they were like, yeah, that's not how that works. And I said, well, that's the way this is going to go. And so they did. I crammed myself in a basement, learned, you know, to play bass in 2 weeks. And, you know, it was rock and roll. It was three chord rock and roll. It wasn't real hard, but apparently I picked it up pretty easily and I played bass in a band for the next 10 years. But that should have been my first indication that I was not a musician. I learned how to play just to keep a band.
But you were good enough. You must be, if you played for 10 years, you're good enough.
Yeah. I mean, I figured it out along the way.
Uh-huh. Wow. And then, but then at some point you went to full-time management.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty, you know, I ultimately segued into full-time management. And that was sort of, you know, I started this company putting out compilation CDs. That was a big thing. I started in 1995 and in the mid 90s, these sort of mixtape CDs were a big thing. And I would find local and regional bands from around the area and put them on this compilation CD and put it out and, you know, see what happens. But from the very first CD we put out, we had one of the biggest hits of the 90s, a song called Sex and Candy by Marcy Playground. Uh-huh. And my intention was I would stick my band right in the middle of all these, you know, big regional bands or bands that I thought was going to be big. And maybe my band would get some attention too. And I think like 9 bands on that first compilation got record deals, except my band. So that was kind of my moment of like realizing, yeah, I'm definitely not. I'm way better on the business side of things.
So then what, tell me then what a manager, a music manager does exactly.
I know.
If they don't get you work.
Sure. Right? It's very different, I would guess, than in the film and TV business. Cause, and I would love to learn this from you, but I'm guessing in the film and TV business, the person that gets you work is the agent. Is
yes.
That, yeah.
The agent and not the manager. And I have
right. Both. And that's what it is here. So a manager in music, I'll put it in the simplest terms, but it's like if the entire career is a wheel, mm-hmm. the manager and the artist are in the center of that wheel. And all these spokes are things like booking agents and publicists and record labels and publishing companies and, you know, people that do film and TV music and all the thing, the accountants, the crew, all the thing, the attorneys that make the machine, the wheel turn. The manager is making sure all of those things are working. So it's sort of like being, I compare it to this. It's being the CEO of a band.
But if you're, go on.
That's all right. The band is owned by the band, or the artist is owned by the, you know, they own their company, but they retain an artist manager, commission an artist manager to manage their career.
But if that band is going on tour, are you expected to go with them?
Only if you're in country music.
Okay, why is that?
It's different. Country music is one of the few genres that still very much lives and dies by the radio. And okay. So the relationships with local radio is very important. So a manager should be there to kind of nurture those radio relationships from town to town to town. Now, if you're in rock and roll or, you know, hip hop or almost any other genre, Americana, folk, bluegrass, most managers do not travel with the band.
But a touring manager would, no?
Now, there's a tour manager, exactly. Right. A tour manager does. And the tour manager is exactly like it sounds. It's the manager of the tour. So it deals with getting the bus from point A to point B and where do we park and what do we, I mean, it's way more than that, but it's the finance of the tour and they report to the artist manager.
Now, over the years, because I've heard you mention this, because you have a very, very big and successful TikTok page, which is how I found you. You've managed a bunch of really big acts, right?
I've had a lot of, and I still do have a lot of big acts. It's been just amazing. I keep waiting for somebody to knock on my door and go, okay, gig's up. Time to get a real job.
Can you share some of them with us?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I got my start with Marcy Playground and I'm still with them 26, 7 years later. But one of my first big clients was the piano player, Bruce Hornsby, who was in the Grateful Dead. And he had a bunch of hits in the 80s and 90s, but he's had a very, very unique career. He's done albums with Ricky Skaggs and jazz records and, but Little Feat, the classic rock band of, they're just so iconic. The band Lit, who had one of the biggest rock hits of the 90s, that song My Own Worst Enemy.
Right.
Some of the country acts that I've worked with, Lainey Wilson, who just won a Grammy, Parmalee. I work with the band Sixpence None the Richer, who had the mega hit Kiss Me. It's been, you know, not to just want, you know, one of the bands I've been with the longest, 23 years, is an 80s rock band from LA called Striper. They were they kind of came up in the ranks with Motley Crue and Bon Jovi and that kind of world of big hair and Sunset Strip and all the things of Hollywood, but they're a Christian band. They sing about Jesus, so they're very, very different than
at this point. Are they finding you? Are new bands finding you? Or are you reaching out to them? How does that work?
Yeah, they usually find me at this point. I don't develop a lot of new acts anymore, mostly because I've just, you know, been doing it a long time, and it's a, you know, developing a new act from garage to Grammy is not only risky, but it's a long runway. And you know, when you've been sort of doing it for as long as I have. And I don't mean any disrespect to anything on this, but you sort of don't need to take that risk anymore.
But it seems like on TikTok, it seems like you're talking to those people.
I am. I'm taking my audience on TikTok is very much the audience that is sort of just trying to figure out the next steps of a very complicated career path.
But they're then why are you talking to them though? If that's not, I assume it's because that's what you're looking for, but no.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. The reason I'm doing it is very pure because it is hard to do this. And right. There's a lot of bad advice flying around out there. And to some extent, I wanted to get on there and level the playing field and just let people know sort of the reality of how the business works. Now, I'm not at all seeking like to manage, you know, a sort of startup man. I'm more than willing. I do some coaching I'm more than willing to sort of help them in these. I'll do these 30-minute sessions where I can kind of really, really fast track things for them, help them avoid years and years of mistakes in a very quick conversation. It's a lot like the stuff that you do in the sense that, like, you know, I'll meet an artist from Topeka, Kansas or wherever. And how you know, they're learning stuff that they would not learn anywhere else only because nobody's ever told them. See, Michael, something that I think we ought to talk about at some point in here is part of why it's difficult to get a manager in the music business is because of how a manager gets paid.
Okay, how do they get paid?
That's a, you know, an interesting dynamic that a lot of people, but even a lot of artists don't know how that works.
Right. So how does that work then?
Yeah. So a manager is paid by commission. So it's strictly a commission base. So if you are an artist and you go out and you play a show or you sell a t-shirt or make some sort of income, a percentage of that income is paid to your manager.
So includes the record deal, includes everything.
It typically includes, and sort of depending on where you are in that artist's career, it includes most every aspect of their entertainment career, including
royalties.
It does include royalties, okay, particularly if those royalties were ones that you helped them earn.
Right.
You know, if you get them a record deal and they continue to earn royalties either through radio play or whatever, yeah, you would earn a commission on that. So you're earning commissions on these revenue streams, and that's typically about 15%.
Okay.
So if you think about, you know, managing, like we talked about the wheel, all those different spokes in the wheel, that's maybe for each act that I manage, that's probably 150 decisions a day that we're making on behalf of that artist. So you can't manage a lot of acts as an individual. You can have a company like we do that has managers that manage acts, but generally speaking, you can't manage a lot of acts because there's a lot that goes into a typical day of that. Mm-hmm. So the commission, if you just break it down to making a living, an artist has to be making significant money for it to be worth that manager's time to spend the bulk of their day managing their career. So when you've got an artist that's just starting out, and I want to get to why it's hard to get advice, when you got an artist that's just starting out and they're making no money and are making very little money, I don't know, $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 a year. You think about that, 15% of that is, you know, $5,000 a year maybe for the manager. So it's really not enough to say, I'm going to dedicate my life to you, which is really kind of what it takes. So as a result, it's almost impossible for an artist to meet a manager. It's really hard to like meet a manager because our time is paid by commission. So that's why I get on TikTok and talk about things I talk about, because I was that bass player in a band, not knowing what the hell I was doing, making every mistake under the sun. And I'm very genuinely just trying to help people not make those mistakes.
Now, you said something a while ago on one of your TikToks, and I was surprised. you don't come down. I thought everyone was supposed to hate Spotify and streaming because of the way, in my opinion, in my point of view, artists are being raped. I mean, that's how I see it, but you don't feel that way.
I don't. I mean, do I think it's a fair payment system? No, I think there's a lot of improvement that needs to happen. Part of what I think is the imbalance is the payments between an artist, a songwriter, and the record label.
Right.
You see, when a song is on Spotify, those are the three main parties that sort of have to get paid, a record label, an artist, and a songwriter. And the songwriters are the ones that are really struggling in this time.
What people pay on Spotify, like I gladly pay double for what I mean, I get every album I want to listen to at any time through the month, you know, almost anything. And if I pay double, I still feel like the artist wouldn't be making not even close to what they used to make.
Well, yes, the art, again, we got to remember there's three buckets we're dealing with: the artist, the record label, and the songwriter. And in some cases, that's the same person in all three of those buckets.
Okay.
Like if you go out and self-release a record and you've written that record and you performed on that record and you do millions and millions of streams on that record, you're making very respectable.
Are you? Because I thought, oh, yeah. I mean, I come at this completely ignorant because I know so little about it. But like, I think I saw a video by like Snoop Dogg saying his album was streamed a billion times and he made 10 cents or something, you know?
That's a famous video. That video circulated a lot. And it's, you know, what is missed most often in that conversation is the difference in those three buckets. My gut tells me, and I don't know Snoop Dogg's complete history, but he probably does not own that recording. So a big chunk of that money that's being earned probably went to his record label. And I don't know, maybe he wrote the song, maybe he didn't. Mm-hmm. If he didn't write the song, he's missing that bucket of income. Or maybe he did write this, you know. So my gut tells me there's more to that story.
So I misunderstand saying, this. Sorry, that's what you, I mean, which is fine. I don't know. I don't know
the full Snoop Dogg, the inner workings of his business, but my gut tells me there's more to that story because I know no shortage of independent artists making a great, great living.
Really?
You know, but the thing that's different and the thing that we got to think about that's different from, say, 2005, say 20 years ago, the biggest difference is the revenue streams now are very multiple. I mean, you know, I met a band the other day that's doing insane six figures just on YouTube.
So they put their music and they make ads on YouTube.
Exactly.
Because they're not selling it.
That's right. So the ad revenue is making four members a living, a very good living.
See, it was my impression that, okay, so 20 years ago, a band would go on tour. And after the show, they'd sell, merch, but they'd also sell the CD. If you want to listen to music, they could sell it. But now no one's going to buy that CD.
They do. They very much buy. Well, more so they buy vinyl.
They buy vinyl.
And you know what's crazy? I was just on the phone with a head of a record label, and he was talking about the rapid increase in the number of cassettes they're selling.
Which is crazy.
It's just such a, you know, I tell people this all the time, but you can't autograph a stream. So you're going to always need to have something that people can take home. I mean, I read the other day of like all the vinyl sold, only like 37% get listened to. But vinyl sales are through the roof.
Really?
They buy the product. They get it autographed. They keep it as a collector's item. And then they stream it on Spotify.
But why do you feel vinyl as opposed to a CD, which is just vinyl but smaller and better quality? Like, why is that?
Yeah, I think CDs, I mean, also depending on the genre, certain genres are very CD. Like country, people still buy CDs. If you go into a Walmart in rural America, you're going to see a lot of country in there. But yeah, I think, you know, I think vinyl partially because it's just big and cool to
It's just
holding,
cool. Yeah, you're right. Because not a lot of people have record, like, you know, a lot of people don't even know how to use a record player like we do. But
yeah, well, I mean, you'd really be surprised, Michael. Huh? It's the vinyl industry is insanely huge.
Interesting.
Yeah, and really among kids. I mean, the kids are buying vinyl. If you go into an Urban Outfitters, which is obviously geared toward 20-somethings, they have a whole record section in there, whole vinyl section in their stores. And they sell record players at Urban Outfitters.
Right, right. I always thought that was ironic. I didn't realize that was they're making money that way.
I know.
I thought they were museum pieces.
Well, probably to some they are. Wow. Yeah.
Now, do you specialize in any kind of genre of music, or does that matter to you?
You know, I'm a rock and roll guy at heart, but I've done a lot of work in sort of songwriter, rock. I've certainly had my share of country acts, although it's not my preferred genre. I've not done a lot in bluegrass, and I've not done a lot in hip hop, but which is strange because if this is a visual thing, I'm staring at a Tupac plaque behind me. So I say, yeah, I don't really work in hip hop, but then I got a Tupac plaque up here.
I have a question for you. Yeah, I don't think you're going to be able to answer this one because I don't know if there's an answer.
Probably not.
But so Daryl Hall has a show that I happen to catch sometimes, like where I think he shoots in his basement or something. Mm-hmm. Or you must have seen it, where he brings in like friends, like 80s stars or whatever. And Daryl's house.
Yeah.
And he's dressed. He looks cool. He's got like a blazer on. He's got dark glasses. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, he looks cool. But then sometimes he brings in other men his age, which is whatever, 70, whatever it is. I don't know.
Yeah.
And they're dressed, and they're stars from the 80s, and they're dressed like they used to dress in the 80s, you know? And I wonder, well, how are aging rock stars supposed to dress? Do you have to answer this to your clients?
We talk about, I mean, you know, I tell artists this all the time, including my big artists, that the biggest mistake you can make with attire, fashion, whatever you want to call it, is to not talk about it. You have to talk about it. As a matter of fact, I recommend to bands, sometimes particularly new bands, take a night and don't bring your instrument, get in a room together and talk about what you want this look to look like. It's so incredibly important, and it's.
But do you have an opinion on what it should be then? Should it stay what it was, or should it evolve?
I think, you know, it's interesting, like this 80s band Striper that I talked about that I manage, you know, from the 80s, that it's the same guys 40 years later. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, there was a lot of hair and makeup and mm-hmm. spandex pants and all the things that, and so, no, they don't wear that anymore. They don't, you know, wear the makeup and the teased hair, but they do, you know, they do an age appropriate version of that. You know, rock and roll gear and rock, you know, it seems
weird because the fans are coming to see their band. The fans don't want the band to age, but unfortunately the band aged, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you give them what they want? You know, it seems like a really hard thing to struggle with.
It is. It's a tough thing. And the good ones, the ones that are really good at this are good at sort of making fun of them. Well, sort of making the audience one with them, and sort of we're all aging together. And
okay.
You know, this is, you know, welcome to us 40 years later.
Right.
What I think we don't want is our aging rock stars to show up in sweatpants and a hoodie. Uh-huh. We want them to show up at least caring and some resemblance of days gone by without being a carbon copy of that, because you shouldn't try to be.
And for the most part, though, I imagine they're playing whatever their greatest hits, the songs that made them big. And the fans, that's what they want to hear. And I imagine if I were a musician who's played the same song 30,000 times, I might get tired of it.
You would think, and here's what happens to a lot of them. Some do. Yeah. they usually don't get tired of it. They get tired of being known only for that. Like there are some artists that have, you know, two or three mega hits so big you can't even compare. And as a result, there's no way for their catalog of, you know, deep catalog of hundreds of songs to sort of surface. It's why the band Little Feat that I worked with, they never really had a radio hit. And they always talked about the best thing that ever happened to us was never having a radio hit, because we never had this super high. Instead, our fans consume our entire catalog. It's a little bit like the Grateful Dead in that sense.
Right.
Like the Grateful Dead never had this mega hit.
Right.
They just had a lifestyle.
Do they complain to you about this though? Or do they, you know, or do they, is this something they talk about?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, one thing that's interesting is when you're on stage and you're playing a 60, 75 minute set or whatever, and you're playing songs from your catalog. One thing that you don't think about a lot, but when they hit that big hit, when they go into playing that big song that everybody knows, of any song in that, it's almost like it's a, for them, it's a welcomed break in the set.
Right.
Meaning when you're playing a new song, you're sort of working really hard to try to work, win this audience over on this new material or this unfamiliar material. So you maybe, you know, if you're a rock band, you're probably moving around a little more. If you're whatever kind of band you are, you're just really giving it your all to win over this crowd. But when you kick into a mega hit that they've heard a million times over, it's a moment you can just breathe.
I see.
I go, okay, you know, I'm good for 3.5 minutes here, because they're going to go nuts no matter what we do.
I would not have thought it. That's interesting you brought that up. I would not have thought about it. I would have thought it the other way around. That, like, oh, fuck, I got to play this again. But then you're good. No.
Yeah, no, I do have a few artists that, you know, that feel that way. One of my favorite moments in that regard was Sean Colvin. She's a kind of a folk songwriter artist, and she did end up having a big hit called Sonny Came Home. And that came out, I guess, in the I'm gonna get the dates wrong, but that was a huge hit, Sonny Came Home. And I went and saw Sean Colvin one night in concert, and she comes out on stage, packed amphitheater, and she says, "We're going to go ahead and play this song for those of you that just came to hear this, so you can go ahead and leave and the rest of us can have a good time."
Is that what happened, though?
And that's what she opened the show with, Sonny Came Home.
And then
I'm paraphrasing what she said there, but it was generally that, like, I'm, for those of you that just came to hear the hit, let's play it. You can go about the way. And sort of the implication was the rest of us who came to hear the entire catalog can now enjoy the show.
Do you think people walked out? I mean,
nobody left. Nobody. I was there. Nobody left.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you know, and that was, that's a bold move.
Yeah.
I love that about her. And that's kind of the way a lot of artists feel about a big hit, is like, they don't dislike it. They love what it's brought to their career. They just dislike it being the only thing people may want to consume.
I think about art, and you must have these conversations with your artists. It's like, how do you reinvent yourself on the next album when your audience doesn't really want you to reinvent you? They want what they have. But if you give them the same, it's also like, yeah, we already have this. It's like, it seems so incredibly daunting to come up with another album that works.
Man, it is. And I, you know, I gotta say, in your world, I would think the same thing. How do you write the next episode given the audience what they want, but still keeping it?
Well, that's when they get mad at you. That's when they say, you know, this show's jumped the shark, or they say this show's died 4 years ago. You know,
jumped the shark. Is that a term?
Oh yeah. I'm surprised you haven't heard it. That refers to an episode of Happy Days when Fonzie and Henry Winkler, they put him on water skis and he had to jump a shark tank.
I remember that.
And he's, and he was wearing a leather jacket. And so that, like, when you saw Fonzie jumping a Shark Tank in a leather jacket, you go, all right, this is the show has jumped a shark.
Oh, I got to remember that.
That's oh, yeah, so it's a awesome. Famous term. Yeah. I worked with Henry years ago and we spoke about that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny.
What did you work on with him?
It was a show called Out of Practice with Henry Winkler and Stockard Channing and Ty Burrell. Mm-hmm. And they were the three main leads. And Henry's like the sweetest man in Hollywood. But we spoke a little bit about that.
Being a child of, you know, sort of growing up in the 80s, I'm going to be remiss if we don't at least. And I'm sorry, man, talk about, you know, asking somebody about their hit. Please tell me about Beavis and Butthead for a minute. I mean, I don't care what you tell me about.
There's very little I can tell you. So I was our friend. This is when they brought the show back. It's been mm-hmm. on three times already. In the second iteration, our friends, John Altschul and Dave Krinsky, they were the showrunners. They created Silicon Valley. And now they're running the second Beavis and Butthead. But that was so they needed freelance writers because it was a really low budget thing. And they reach out to us. And the money was terrible, but we just had a break in we were in between shows. So the timing was perfect. They said, mm-hmm. do you want to write some Beavis and Butt? So we pitched them maybe 10 ideas. They bought four but that was it. I mean, that was kind of the involvement. Then we went to see Mike Judge. We went to the record session. So we'll go to the booth and we're all watching videos. And we're standing over his shoulders, watching music videos, just pitching jokes about what Beavis and Butt would say. And then he would go into the booth, do the voice, and come back out. But that was my involvement. So it was only it was just a fun experience. It was not.
Well, sure, absolutely. I mean, what a But again, coming into it sort of midstream like that, what an even harder job. You've got hits. You want to give the audience mm-hmm. what they expect, but you also want to give them what they don't expect. How you do that as an artist is hard.
And do you have these conversations with your bands?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and it's, yes, because the funny thing about music is none of us, if we sit down and listen to our Spotify list or whatever, and we have our catalog of music, none of us listen to one kind of music. We listen to all kinds of music, jazz and reggae and rock and whatever. We all have a mixture of taste, and depending on our mood, we want to explore that music. It's the same with artists. They don't think in one genre. Mm-hmm. They're artists. They're thinking all over the place. So it's really hard for them creatively to stay in this lane. It's why you see so many artists, I'm going to try to do a country record, or I'm going to try to do, some other exploratory record. And that's okay if you're Prince. Mm-hmm. You look like a genius if you're Prince. If you're just starting out, you look confused.
Yeah.
I don't know what I want to do, so I'm going to do a jazz song. So yeah, we do talk a lot about trying to stay. It's a terrible term for art, but trying to stay on brand with both your look and your sound and your music. And the audience, when they go to buy a Bruce Springsteen record, they don't want to hear a jazz record. Right. They want to hear good American rock and roll songs.
But they also don't want to hear, I think you too may struggle with this. I think they got their sound, and it's like, all right, but I've already heard it.
They do struggle with that. Yeah, they've had a couple, and almost any act has their moment of like, when they look back on it, it's kind of like, what was I thinking?
Right. They say, I mean, to me, it sounds like I haven't listened to them in a while, but there, at one point I got an album, I just thought it just sounded like every other, and they were amazing in the, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It seems like a very hard balancing act. How do you do this?
It's why bands like Kiss, for example, it was over 20 years since they recorded new music, just because they didn't want to attempt to top what they had done.
I heard an interview by Tears for Fears, and they were talking about, and I didn't know this because I don't know the inside of music at all, but they were talking about how at one point the album, I guess mid-career, that they were assigned a music producer, and the producer kind of determined the sound. And I was like, I was surprised. I really thought that that's what they did. I thought they wrote all their songs, and instead they were hearing songs written for them. I did not know that. I was really surprised because they are songwriters.
They are songwriters. And sometimes when a band or an artist hits that moment of like, how do we feed our fan base but stay ahead of things? Sometimes a good producer or outside writer can help move that along.
On their last album, they shunned all that. They did it themselves. And yeah. I thought the album was terrific.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't heard it, but I've heard people say that. Because they really went for the middle lane that they developed mm-hmm. all along with their fan base. I mean, they're brilliant. They're a brilliant act with an incredible catalog.
Yeah. How do you then, I mean, in the management world, at least, you know, in TV, in film, it's not, and for agents as well, it's not atypical for a writer or an actor to get to some point and then they leave their manager or their agent. Maybe they outgrow them or something happens. And how do you reconcile that?
Yeah, that happens all the time in the music business. We call it the revolving door of, you know, managers and artists. I've had some come and go and come back and go.
Do you not take it personally then, or what?
One of the things you have to do is truly not take it personally. And mm-hmm. sometimes, you know, it's sort of like, I look at it like this, like if you were to own a restaurant and that restaurant grows and changes and evolves, a different manager has different skill sets. We're not all great at everything. Mm-hmm. We're good at certain things. And if you happen to be at the place in your career to where you're with a manager that is good at the things you need, that's a perfect relationship. If you happen to go outside of that, mm-hmm. then you might need someone with a different skill set. And oftentimes a manager is the first to say, I feel like I've taken you as far as I can.
Really?
Let's find something new here. It's no different than like a football coach or a restaurant manager or any sort of leader mm-hmm. of a company. Sometimes for a lot of reasons, the stars align, and sometimes they just don't. And if they don't, it's usually pretty recognizable to both parties. And there's very rarely, I mean, you certainly hear the stories both online and elsewhere of manager artist fallout, but by and large, I'm friends with every artist I've ever worked with, and I've never had a, I mean, like, I don't manage Bruce Hornsby anymore, but I just went, you know, backstage, we went to his show and hung out with him after the show, and we talked about old times and had a good hang together.
Right.
But there was a point in his career where I was, and a point in my career where we just weren't at the same place. And I don't even mind sharing that.
Yeah, please.
He had been on RCA Records for about 25 years. And the top brass at RCA was kind of changing, you know, again, the revolving doors of executives at a record label. Mm-hmm. It was Tom. And so his life at RCA, his deal and relationship at RCA started to come to an end. And I was really, really, I had two other bands at RCA. I was sort of really inside the walls of RCA Records at the time. And so I wasn't really best suited for his the next step in his career, which was to find a new label, a New York-based label. I was very much Nashville-centric at that point. And it was just kind of, you know, came to a place where I felt like for him to go where he needed to go, he needed somebody else, and he felt the same. And
And but that's another thing, because I see with my management, you know, they have relationships at studios, and as you do have relationships, and there's, you know, at the end of the day, you you have your interests, and like, you, it's not like you're going to burn bridges with these studio, you know, that you have relationships with. You know, you can only fight so much because of what you have with your other clients, right?
That's right. Yeah. You know, this is a, it's probably like your business. It's a very small business.
Yeah.
At a certain level, it's a very small business. There's not a lot of, you're going to run into everybody again.
Yeah.
And at some point you're going to want your act touring with their act, or you're going to want their act being featured on a record of your act. And if you burn bridges, it's just going to, yeah, I mean, I know people that do burn bridges, but it's rarely good.
You are listening to What the Hell is Michael Jammin Talking About? Today's episode is brought to you by my new book, A Paper Orchestra, A Collection of True Stories. John Mayer says it's fantastic. It's multi-timbral. It runs all levels of the pyramid at the same time. His knockout punches are stinging sincerity. And Kirkus Review says, those who appreciate the power of simple stories to tell us about human nature, or who are bewitched by a storyteller who has mastered his craft, will find a delightful collection of vignettes, a lovely anthology that strikes a perfect balance between humor and poignancy. So, you know, my podcast is not advertiser supported. I'm not running ads here. So if you'd like to support me or the podcast, come check out my book. Go get it, an ebook or a paperback, or if you really want to treat yourself, check out the audiobook. Go to michaeljammin.com/book. And now back to our show.
What is then the pinnacle for, I mean, we know what the pinnacle for an artist's career would be, whatever, you know, selling a ton of records, playing the Super Bowl, whatever they aspire to do. But what's the pinnacle for your career?
That's a great question. Yeah. I it's interesting. I was taking my son to school the other day and he said, Daddy, work seems like it's really fun. Okay. Is work really fun? And he's come to my office before, and I got thinking about that, and like, you know, I've chosen a path that really is fun. Mm-hmm. I've never, this sounds corny to say, I've never felt like I've worked a day in my life.
Really?
It just really has never felt like work. Okay. I'm so amazed that people pay me to do this, because I was doing it long before I knew you could make money at it. Mm-hmm. And so the pinnacle for me is really that, this continued joy of the business of music. You know, I've had, there's very few high level artists, celebrities I haven't met or come in contact with. And so none of that is really the moment. For me, it's seeing an act, like this band, Parmalee, that we're looking at. They're a country act. They've had 4 or 5 number one hits. They were playing in their garage in Greenville, North Carolina, a small town where I grew up. Mm-hmm. I happened to just know them, and I took them to Nashville. One thing, so you know, that's sort of what this business is for me. You see a band in a garage, and the next thing you know, they're accepting an award on stage. And it's just a beautiful feeling to know that you've helped an artist
right
achieve those dreams.
Interesting. Cause that's not, it's interesting that that's where you take the joy in, because you're not, I would think that part of, you know, you're not the one who wants that dream. You're not the one, you're not the one who wants that dream. This is your dream. You take joy in doing it for others.
I would think there's similar satisfaction in being a writer. I would think maybe you were motivated to be on screen all the time or on in front of the camera all the time, but
not really. But I think writers are worried about their career. Like, I want to write this. I want to make a lot of money, or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah. Well, the money is certainly an enjoyable part of it.
Yeah.
But it's not the driving factor, and it can't be in music because it's so risky.
Now, but arrange events, right?
Oh, wow. You did your homework. Yeah. So around the turn of the century, I live in Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm in Nashville almost weekly, but I live in Raleigh, North Carolina. And in Raleigh, North Carolina, there are not a lot of artist management or record labels. Mm-hmm. It's a big, you know, very creative music city, but there's not a lot of high level. So as Raleigh started to feel like they needed entertainment in their city and started thinking about amphitheaters and growth and expansion of their city, they kind of came to me saying, you know, you've had artists play in these cities all over the country. Could you help us bring the good, bad, and the ugly of that to Raleigh and help us produce events? So over the past 20 years, I've become the kind of go-to. I produce the North Carolina State Fair and all the big festivals.
But you keep it to this one region, though.
I do. I pretty much stay in the central, the eastern North Carolina region. And it's funny because when bands go out on tour, I'm managing bands. Like I learned from Bruce Hornsby one time, I called him, you know, I'd always check in after the show and how did it go and whatever. And he went and played one show somewhere. And I said, how was the show? And he said, and he kind of laughed while I said this, but he said, I was staring at a funnel cake sign the whole time.
You know, what does that mean?
Funnel cakes, like, so you're playing like this car, almost like a carnival, you know, not that there's anything wrong with that. And there's plenty of respect in funnel cakes, but, but as an artist who played in the Grateful Dead, right, done jazz records, not really his thing. So I kind of made a joke of to always keep the funnel cake stand a little bit away from the stage, but I took all of this feedback from artists, what the backstage was like, what the stage was like, what the PA was like, what the lights were like. I took all the good, bad, and the ugly from the artist, and I brought it back to my community to try to make the best concerts and events.
I imagine there was a huge, not just a learning curve, but also a financial risk in the beginning for you, no?
Yeah, I racked up a lot of credit cards.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I sure did. We started this company on a credit card, and that's what got us going. We produced CDs on a credit card. We racked up a lot of credit card debt, hoping this would win.
What do you have? And it's paid off.
It's paid off.
Right.
I paid it off last week.
Just last week, you made your final payment. you got points for it. But what advice then do you have for, I guess, new artists? I mean, either musicians or, I don't know, artists.
Yeah. I think the hardest thing to do, particularly in this world of TikTok and YouTube and Reels, is to really be authentically you. Mm-hmm. Because it's so easy to want to try to be like the person that just went viral.
Right.
And that's never going to move the needle. That's never going to make a big splash. You might have a moment. I don't know if you remember, there maybe 3 or 4 months ago, there was an artist on TikTok named Oliver Anthony that went massively viral. A bearded guy from the mountains and kind of just sang very pure songs, but went enormously huge. And within weeks, you've got every mountain guy with a beard trying to do the same thing. Uh-huh. And you just, it's really hard to not do that when we're faced with that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day of Led Zeppelin, the Rolling Stones and everything else, one didn't really know what the other was doing.
Right.
So you went into your bubble and you created art in a way that you felt led to do. And now you're so pressured to try to be like the next viral thing. And that's the hardest thing. So my advice is don't do that.
Yeah. You also, it's funny because, you know, I'm a fan of your TikToks. You give such interesting, great advice. You gave one post, this is maybe half a year or maybe a year ago, I don't know. And I was like, yes, I wanted to stitch it, but I guess I just didn't have the balls. And then I forgot about it. The post you did was, I guess a lot of people come to you for advice and they just think they can just, you know, hey, you pick your brain or buy you a cup of coffee as if your time is worth $5 an hour, because that's what coffee costs. And but you handled it very gracefully and graciously. But I'm not sure what kind of did you get any blowback for it?
You know, yeah. I mean, you know, you're on TikTok, you know, the blowback. You definitely get, but by and large, no. But by and large, what I ended up getting is it's been beautiful, actually. Ever since then, I've got a lot of artists coming to me saying, look, I'm not going to offer to buy you a cup of coffee because I know how you feel about that, but I would like 30 minutes of your time. And how would I go about doing that?
Right.
And that's, you know, that's a beautiful way. I mean, I really picked this up from an attorney one time, and I was on the three-way call with an artist, an attorney, and myself. And the artist said to the attorney, hey, I got this contract and I don't really have a lot of money to spend, but I was hoping you could read it over and I could, you know, buy you a cup of coffee and pick your brain on it.
Yeah. What did the attorney say?
And the attorney said, look, I understand you mean well, but I only have two things to sell. I've got my time and my knowledge, and you have just asked for both of those things for free.
Yes. That's a good way of saying it.
And I just thought, wow, that's right. I mean, and as a manager, that's what you have. You got your time, your knowledge, and your connections. And if you're picking my brain, you are asking for those things for free. And I don't have anything else to feed my family with.
But I wonder, is it because people ask me the same thing. And I guess it's because some people are actually giving it to them for free that they could. Do you think?
It is. Yeah. I mean, they must be, or otherwise they wouldn't be doing it. Yeah. I guess it's.
But then I wonder if you're only paying $5, then if you're only paying $5 for advice, and that advice is only worth $5. I mean, why would you want to take $5 advice? You know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's been a tough part of the music business because, so that thanks for noticing that. But I do think we as a sort of service society, whether you're, you know, a screenwriter or whether you're a manager, an agent or whatever, all people really have is what's in their head and their time. And so to take that so lightly is to think that, you know, buying you lunch is going to somehow make it worthwhile. It just doesn't, you know, it's not only doesn't make sense, in a strange way, it's rude.
Well, I don't think it's strange. I mean, I do think it's rude.
As I said, I think in that TikTok, I said, I understand you're offering to buy me something. So I understand that you're trying to be, in your own way, polite, but let me just educate you. That's not a compliment to say that, you know, your time is worth a cup of coffee.
But I appreciated that video. I really did. I was like,
do you get a lot of people asking to pick your brain?
Yes. I guess a few, less and less.
But you do some consulting as well, right?
Well, what I did was I signed up for, there's this app where you can sign up to be an expert. And so people ask me a question. Sometimes it's an autoresponder and it says, if you want to book time with Michael, you can do so here. I can, like a half a dozen people have booked, like no, everyone's asking, but no one books time. So and I didn't do it because that's, you know, to make money, but I was like, well, look, if you want it, this is, you're going to have to pay, you know, but they don't want it bad enough to pay. So,
it's interesting. I'm on a platform called artistmanagers.io and that's where I do my 30-minute consultations, and I've partially used it as a filter. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's funny, like I'll get artists that go out and spend $10,000 on recording and, you know, $10,000 on video and photo shoots. And then they'll come to me and say, can I pick your brain for a cup of coffee?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you have just spent $20,000 making music. Yeah. And now the most important part, getting it out to the public, that's worth a cup of coffee to you.
Yeah.
So I sort of use this platform as a filter. It's like chemistry 101 in college. If you can get, if you're willing to just invest a tiny bit to spend a little bit of time with a professional, I at least know you're serious.
Yeah, I that's how I see it as well. So, you know, you're weeding people out. They don't really want, like, they're not, I guess that's not how, that's how, you know, unserious they are. That, you know, if they're getting caught up on booking a half hour with me, then you're, they don't really want.
I would think in your world, people want to want you to read their script.
Is that, there's a lot of that, but you got to pay me way more than, I mean, here's the thing, like, I don't even do it. So, but they all want it. They want me to spend an hour and a half reading their script, another hour assembling notes, and then another hour on a phone call, them giving them my notes while they get angry and defensive, telling me why I'm wrong.
Yeah.
And do it for free. I mean, okay. That sounds like a ball to me. So, but it's not about the money. Like, the answer is no all around, but it also exposes me to liability side, because I don't want to be sued for taking someone's idea. So.
Totally. I mean, that's a big part of the music business. A lot of, you know, you hear about unsolicited music, and a lot of people, myself included, will not even open an email with music attached if I don't know who it is.
Is it because of, for liability reasons?
Yeah.
They think you're going to steal their sound or their song?
You know, I think, yes, I think they do think that. And I think in the history of the music business, that has happened maybe three times. I mean, it just doesn't happen. So it's funny that that's a topic even. I don't know if that happens in the film and TV business, but in the music business, anytime you've heard of a lawsuit of one suing the other about a sound, it's very rarely actual theft.
Uh-huh.
It's most often, you know, that there's only eight chords.
Right.
And you can arrange them in only so many ways. And if you're in a genre like hip hop or country where it's, you know, in some ways a little bit of a formula in the way your pop music is that way, you write very narrow melodies and chord progressions, it's bound to your I mean, about the 100,000 songs released a day, you're bound to cross paths there in a close manner. It's very rarely malicious.
So then how are you listening to new music, if at all? Is it because you see an act on stage or something?
Yeah, no, I will listen to it if it's coming to me from a vetted source, or if it's coming to me in a way that I feel. But, you know, I get a lot of just very blind emails, like never met, seen, heard of the person. Yeah. And one of my favorite quotes was, you know, Gene Simmons said one time, look, if I'm hearing about you for the first time from you, you're not ready.
You're not ready. Interesting.
Because we keep our ears to the ground. I mean, I'm hearing about artists all the time. I mean, I can't go to the dentist without hearing about five new artists. People know that we work in the music business. So no matter where I go, the coffee shop, the dentist, the pizza shop, whatever, they're going to tell me about their cousin that just released a song that's the next Beatles. So I hear about stuff. And if I hear about it from 7, 8, 9 different places, I start to know there's something there.
Right. I directed Gene Simmons, by the way, on an animated show. I had a yell.
No way.
Well, he came into the studio like a rock star, like which is what
of
he
course.
Is. And then he's holding court and, hey, dude, we're paying for this thing. You know, I got to get, you know, and I knew I was going to get yelled at by my boss. Like, so I had to say, hey, Gene, we're recording now. Like, I had to tell him to shut him, get under the microphone. You know,
oh, that's awesome. He is a really interesting person. I've met him a couple of times. I really, you know, I'm amazed by his story.
That's funny. Chrissy Hynde came in. My partner had to direct Chrissy Hynde, and she came in also like a rock star into the booth, and she's smoking a cigarette, and you're not supposed to with the equipment.
Right.
And he asked her to put it out, and she wouldn't. And he was like, that's fine with me. what are you going to do?
I love it.
She's Chrissy Hynde. She gets to do what she wants. But that's so interesting. I get that same. Sometimes when people ask me a question, and I wonder if you feel the same way, where, you know, about breaking into the business or some kind of basic thing, they leave a comment, and I'm like, all you got to do is just scroll down, and all my videos are labeled. Like, you're gonna find it. I wonder how bad you want it if you feel like you have to ask me without looking, you know? This is literally the least you have to do to find an answer nowadays, you know?
I did a video recently where one of the most common questions I get is somebody will present their music to me and they'll say, do you think I have what it takes to make it?
Right.
And that is without question the hardest question to answer because I don't know your definition of make it.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, a lot of people don't know their definition of make it. I had a band come into my office one time. They finally, you know, they've been wanting to line up a meeting. They came in and they said, I said, so what do you guys want to do? What are you hoping to do? And they said, well, you know, we want to be successful. You know what I mean? And I said, well, no, I don't know what you mean. Tell me what success means to you. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, we want to make a living at music.
Okay.
I said, well, that's good. I can have you doing that within 30 days. And they kind of looked at me like, wow, we hit the jackpot coming to this meeting. Uh-huh. And I said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to buy you a bunch of tuxedos. You're going to learn some top 40 songs. We're going to play the wedding and corporate cover circuit.
Right.
A great living. They kind of looked at you and they were like, no, that's not what we meant. Okay, let me change that answer. We want to make a living playing our music.
Okay.
I said, all right, a little bit harder to do, but we can still do it. There's sports bars around the country where you kind of set up in the corner and they don't really care what you play, your background music, but you make a pretty decent living. You'll make good tips. And they were like, no, let me think about this. They thought about it for a little bit more and they said, okay, we got it. We want to be on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And then one other guy spoke up and he said, playing our music.
Right.
I said, okay, I got you. My friend does the Sunday night local show on the radio station. He's a friend of mine. He'll play anything I send him. I'll send him your song. He'll play it on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
You will have been successful.
Right.
And they like, all right. And one guy spoke up at that point and he said, I see what you're trying to do. You're mm-hmm. trying to confuse us. I said, no. You know, you're quite confused on your own.
Yeah.
I'm trying to do is point out that I can't help you until you know what you want.
Right.
And there's no wrong answer to that. Some artists come to me and say, I want world domination. I want to be the next big, huge thing. And others simply say, I just want to make great music. And you know, I don't really care if I make a living. I just want a good quality music out there.
Is that right?
But I imagine
you got to pay for your bills. That's not attractive to you, right?
It's not attractive to me, and that's okay. But there's still a place for that in this world.
Uh-huh.
Here's the other thing. A lot of people think they want that world domination and play in arenas, but the moment we start saying things like, well, you know, let's say a country artist came to me. And they said, I want to be the biggest country star in the world. First thing out of my mouth would be, you're going to need to move to Nashville. You don't need to do that in every genre, but in country, that's a must be present to win town. You're going to have to be in Nashville. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I don't really want to do that because I got, you know, this and a job and whatever. Yeah. So I tell people all the time, prioritize where music is in your life. It doesn't have to be number one. But just knowing where it is will help you make decisions on what's most important. When I give advice to artists, I often ask them, do you have kids and are you married? And tell me about your personal life. Because the truth is, the advice I give to someone with a 2-month-old baby at home is different than a single 21-year-old that can, you know, go out and explore the world.
Right. What do you think it is that people like me, Hollywood, what do we get wrong about the music industry when we portray it on TV and film?
Oh, wow. Well, it's funny because in every music-based show, like I used to watch the show Nashville,
mm-hmm.
which was produced very well, and it was done in Nashville, so it had a lot of authenticity to it. But I don't think you get it wrong. I think you have to portray it this way because that's the way TV is made.
Mm-hmm.
But you can go from, like, you know, in one episode, writing a song to going on tour with Bon Jovi all within, you know, a week or two's time, what seems like a week or two's time in a film or TV show. And it's a laborious, long, as you know, from any any aspect of entertainment. It's years before he starts to take off from that runway. It's it's a several year runway. But I think the public, as a result of just all of our short attention spans, shows and even movies have to be written so that what seems like in, you know, a couple of months, couple of weeks, sometimes you go from writing this song to touring with Beyonce.
Why do you think, and I say this for my, because selfishly, because I want to know for myself, why do you think the runways take is so long before you take off? What is that? Like, why does that mean? Why does it take so long?
Well, I think it's, you know, I think a lot of it is because writing music, like writing anything, takes a lot of hours to get good at it.
Okay, but let's say you got your album out and it's a great album. Now, it's going to take years before.
No, it's going to take years to get that great album.
Right. Okay. Right.
Once that great album is assembled and together, it can be a relatively, I mean, it can be a relatively short runway to success.
Right.
Once that great, you know, in Nashville, there's a saying, when somebody comes in to meet with a publisher, and a publisher is someone who oversees the copyrights of songs. But when someone comes to meet with a publisher and they say, you know, how many songs have you written? No matter what the answer is, they almost always say, come back when you've written your next 100.
Really?
There's kind of a unwritten 7-year rule in Nashville. Mm-hmm. Like you should not expect success for at least 7 years after you come to town.
With your first album, you know, right.
With your first set of releases. It just takes that long to get really, really top level good at this.
Okay.
In any genre, I think. I mean, that, you know, for it, if there was a comment section on this podcast, there would be tons of people giving me the exceptions to those rules right now.
Right.
Which is the beauty of the music business or any entertainment. There's exceptions to that rule. There's overnight sensations.
Right.
But by and large, most of the big artists had a long runway.
So you're listening, if you were listening to an album by a, you know, new artist, you're thinking, okay, maybe one or two songs has got something and the rest are just not there, you're saying.
Sometimes, yeah, sometimes. I mean, you take a band like, it's funny, that first hit I worked with, Sex and Candy, the band Marcy Playground, between the time they wrote and recorded that and it became a number one hit was 4 years.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. So
4 years.
Right. Okay. So they had that, they had the goods, but it took 4 years before people discovered they had the goods.
That's right. That was a very interesting journey. They charted on college radio, and then they tried to work to regular radio. It didn't happen. And they, you know, label problems, and they tried again, and it finally happened. Same thing with this band, Sixpence None the Richer, and the song Kiss Me. They had that song Kiss Me on a record, and it did not become a hit for another 2 years.
So, wow. Okay. So, what is, then how do they do that? Is it just touring? Is it just getting it out? Is it just having people listen?
In the 90s, it was touring. It was just getting out there and touring.
But not today, you're saying. It's not like that today.
It's not. I mean, it's some. Touring is one aspect of it. But the beauty of, you know, Michael, you and I would not be here talking if it were not for TikTok. And that, you know, as much as I love to hate on social media platforms for all the reasons they're easy to hate on, I tell artists this all the time, there is someone in Topeka, Kansas right now that loves what you do.
Yeah.
You just got to find them. Mm-hmm. And if you do, they'll be they'll be fans for life. But unless you plan on touring Topeka, Kansas this week, you're not going to find them. So get online and post.
How many, I've heard numbers, and I don't know if it's true, but how many rabid fans do you need? Do you think a band needs before they hit critical mass?
Well, critical mass is a, you know, subjective term, but
yeah,
I say this a lot. You only need 1,000 fans. And I'm talking about real fans that would give the shirt off their back fans. I'm not talking about followers.
Okay.
I'm not talking about likes or subscribes.
Right. People who open their wallet.
1,000 fans that consume everything you put out. That's all you need to make a great living in music.
But how is that possible? Okay, so if you've got 1,000 fans, they're scattered all across the country. And I don't understand how does that make you a good living? You can put out a new album. How do you, to 1,000 fans, how does that make you a living?
I'll tell you how that is. Because when I was 10 years old, I had a older cousin, Cousin Rick, and I went to his house and he had a wall of vinyl records, mm-hmm. like more vinyl records than you could ever imagine. And he reached and he had got a new stereo and he wanted to show me the stereo. And he pulled up a Boston record, the classic rock band Boston. Mm-hmm. They had just put out their first record and he put it on the turntable and he was telling me everything he needed to tell me about Boston. And I was just mostly fascinated by the fact that of 1,000 records on his wall, he picked that one to tell me about it. Mm-hmm. And from there, I went and bought the record. I consumed I bought the t-shirts. I bought this. The thing about 1,000 fans is they're your marketing arms. Mm-hmm. 1,000 fans are not going to keep your music close to their chest and keep it right over here in the corner. They're going to tell everybody that'll possibly listen. Mm-hmm. And if you have somebody, if you've got a fan that it gets in the car with their friends and they got 3 minutes to the next drive, mm-hmm. and a billion songs to choose from, they're going to choose yours. And that's going to turn those fans, right, those friends into fans. So it starts with 1,000 core fans and you can really take over the world.
I wonder, and I say this selfishly because I put out a book. And so this is the first venture I've done solo like this. And so I'm curious, like how many, when do I go viral? Like, how does that work for me? Like, when do my 1,000 fans kick in and how does that
work? I think a book is the hardest thing in the world. I'm about to release my third book and it is the hardest thing. God bless you. This is a great book. And by the way, everybody, John Mayer endorses it. I loved your video on John Mayer, great? By the way.
Yeah.
That's insane. But yeah, I hope your 1,000 fans I feel like they're out there.
Because you think, because no one wants to read, you're saying.
No, I think fans do want to read. Do you have an audio version of this?
Yeah, I have an audio book.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got them covered whether they want to read or not.
Right. Right. Interesting. Okay.
Did you read the book for the audio version?
It's a performance. I perform it, really. It's a performance. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I'll have to listen to that. That sounds really interesting. No, I think, I think 1,000 fans can be your marketing champions, but getting those 1,000 is hard. It's the equivalent of having 1,000 really good friends.
Right.
That really care about what you do. They're passionate about your cause, your reason for doing this.
Do you have any evidence to suggest that 1,000 is the right number? You know what I'm saying?
I don't.
Right.
I know this. You know, there's a lot. One of the revenue streams right now for artists is things like Patreon.
Right.
And Patreon's a big thing for the super fan. The super fan will give you a little bit of money each month, $3, $5, $10 to consume a little extra insight into your life, whether that be unreleased songs or behind the scenes videos or whatever that might be.
And that seems hard though, but I'm sorry, go ahead.
If you have 1,000 people willing to give you $5 a month,
right,
cup of coffee. Back to our cup of coffee.
Right.
$5 a month. That's $5,000 a month just on that one revenue stream. They are also going to consume your music. They're going to buy your t-shirts. They're going to come to your shows. But more importantly, 1,000 fans can quickly turn viral into 10,000 when they're passionately telling everyone under the sun about you.
But you must talk about this with your bands about starting a Patreon. But don't they say, well, we are already posting on social media. What the hell else do we have to say behind a paywall when we're already saying everything, we're already struggling to give enough for free.
The thing that I'm finding is working the most is one-on-one or experiences. Like, for example, I have this one artist that does listening parties on their Patreon. They go on and they play their music and they'll talk about the making of it and they'll pause the record and they'll say, you know, hey, I was trying this solo and it didn't work. And these are one-on-one and the people are shooting questions and the artist is answering them and they're not recorded and they happen in the moment. And so for an extra $5 a month, you get to get inside the life of that artist.
And you can put that inside Patreon.
Yeah.
How do you, but how is it being broadcast?
So it's being broadcast just on a Zoom, but only patrons have that link and they, they have a special code to get in and all that sort of stuff.
And that's kind of what they're doing. That for $5 a month, you get basically that.
You get experiences. Some artists are it really depends on your fan base. Some artists release a song per month. They'll write a song and release it. Got a Texas artist that I'm friends with that's what he does. He releases a song only to his Patreon crowd once a month. He's such a prolific writer. He could probably write an album per month. So putting an extra song on Patreon that nobody else hears is...
And no one else will hear that song?
Nobody else will.
Ever? I mean, that seems almost crazy.
Well, I wouldn't say ever, but in some ways you can use Patreon as your vetting for what songs you should be releasing.
Interesting.
You can put them out there to your 1,000 hardcore fans and watch which ones they really react to.
Do you have a Patreon?
I don't personally, no. I run a lot of Patreons for artists. Right. But I don't personally have one, no.
Those are all interesting ideas. What are any other? No, but I've been... Here's the thing, Dave. Like, I every time I should, but I'm like, do I really want to put more on my plate? You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's putting stuff on your plate.
You've got a great course. I've been very much admiring your ability to put out courses. One of the things I've liked that you've done, I've noticed, is you put out very specific topics for a pretty low amount.
Well, it's free. I do these webinars that are free.
The free webinars are insane. I mean, but that's got, I would think that's got to help in the overall big picture of things. No, maybe.
Yes and no. Maybe yes and no. We could talk more about. Maybe we'll talk more about that off the podcast. I'll get your advice on something. Yeah.
But you do have courses, right? I mean,
I have one course. Yeah. It's a screenwriting course. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, that's, you know, somebody might buy that in the middle of the night and you're making money without.
Yeah. Right. Which is nice. So that supports me. That allows me to do the creative things that I want to do that don't necessarily make a lot of money but I want to do them. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you working on right now that you're able to tell?
Oh, well,
you're able to share. You
know, right now, it's about getting my book out there. I have, we're pitching an animated pilot in the next couple of weeks. Will it sell? I don't know. We'll see. And then we'll pitch a couple other shows. Will it sell? We don't know. You know, that's how it goes.
I want to mention that real quick as it relates to your music audience. That's a big question. I guess somebody will write a song and send it to me and say, do you think I could sell this to another artist? Mm-hmm. Which is interesting because in music, it does not work that way at all. You don't sell a song.
I think you write a song to some. I think you could be a songwriter for somebody. So what's the difference then?
So when you write a song, you basically give that song to an artist. Mm-hmm. And if that artist chooses to cut it, you earn a revenue stream on that.
Right. Okay.
But you don't sell songs. Big misconception in the music business.
But I guess I'm not clear on the difference then. Like, if you wouldn't you send them like a track and say, do you like this? And then you have to send them a track. They have to hear it, right?
Yeah, they have to hear it. And if they like it, they cut it.
Yeah.
They don't pay you for that song. You know, whenever that song is played on the radio, you get a royalty stream from that, or you get a royalty stream
from
it's spun on Spotify, you get a royalty stream from that. But the artist is not buying a song from you. And by the way, you still own that song. So you can take that song to someone else and to someone else and to someone else. That's why you have lots of different cover versions of
song. So you could get three different artists. I would have thought if you what I'm so sorry. I meant to put this on silent. I mean, right now.
I can't hear.
Oh, okay. I would have thought when, you know, if what whoever major, whatever, Taylor Swift, if, I don't know, maybe she probably writes all her own music, but if she didn't, if she were to, you know, agree to record your song, I would have thought she'd say, no, it's me and me alone.
It's, you can't do that. It's not the way. Yeah. I mean, she could say, I'm the first one to do it.
Okay.
You can't let someone else do it first. But once a song, this is an interesting part of the music business, but once a song is in the public domain, once it's been released, anyone can cover it.
Right.
Day Taylor Swift releases a song, you, Michael Jammin, can go the very next day and record that song, as long as the proper royalties are paid to her as the songwriter.
Well, why is that not done more often then?
You don't even need to ask her permission. I mean, it is done. Just hop on Spotify or YouTube. If you take any song, take a Taylor Swift song and just search YouTube or search Spotify, and you're going to see hundreds of versions of that song.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Wow. See, I'm learning all this stuff. This has been a very eye-opening conversation for me.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Next week, I'm going to reverse the question. I'm going to be asking you questions. If I had a podcast, you'd be my first guest.
I would appreciate that. No, I would do it in a heartbeat. This is Dave Rose. Thank you so much. And I want to make sure everyone knows where they can follow you on all their social media.
Yeah, I mean, if you search, so the name of my company is Deep South. If you search Dave Rose Deep South on almost any, I mean, stick it in Google and that'll take you everywhere.
You need to go.
Yeah.
Go follow him. There's so much overlap, I feel, between the things that we say, but yet still, I feel like I learn a lot just by listening to you and watching you.
Likewise, when I started following your page, I was like, wow, there is a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
In this business.
Yeah. It's so interesting. But thank you again so much.
Thank you.
What a wonderful conversation. Don't go anywhere. Don't stay right there. Yeah. All right, everyone. What a great conversation we had. Go follow Dave Rose in Deep South. And until next week, keep writing.
Wow, I did it again. Another fantastic episode of What the Hell is Michael Jammin Talking About? How do I do it week after week? Well, I don't do it with advertiser-supported money. I tell you how I do it. I do it with my book. If you'd like to support the show, if you'd like to support me, go check out my new book, A Paper Orchestra. It asks the question, what if it's the smallest, almost forgotten moments that are the ones that shape us most? Laura Sanjagoma says, good storytelling also leads us to ourselves, our memories, our beliefs, personal and powerful. I loved the journey. And Max Muchnick, who was on my show, says, as the father of daughters, I found Michael's understanding of parenting and the human condition to be spot on. This book is a fantastic read. Go check it out for yourself. Go to michaeljammin.com/book. Thank you all, and stay tuned. More great stuff coming next week.